She is such a. She's so nice. You know, this whole. Who have you met from the cast so far? Mick and Kristanna.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're all. I mean, they're just all like super nice people who you'd like to have come over to your house for brunch, you know? I mean, they're just, you know, there's some actors who at the end of the day, it's like, okay, you see you tomorrow. And it's like, that's the first time you want to see them. They are just so nice and warm and funny and gracious and all incredibly talented. So it was with some amount of guilt that I tortured them for 6 months shooting this movie.
Looking at this movie, at first I thought, well, I really don't like the look of it. And then I realized it's because it takes place in the real world. All our sci-fi
Yeah,
blockbusters are heightened
right.
reality and color stuff. And then I thought, okay, well, this is cool because this could happen to whoever. Did you keep that in mind when you're filming?
Yeah. The whole way I thought to make a movie, I mean, when you think about Terminator, the premise of Terminator is that robots from the future that look like Arnold Schwarzenegger are traveling back in time to our present day. And that's kind of a crazy idea. So the way to make that believable, to really draw an audience into the experience of the movie and get them excited, is to shoot it in a way that they feel like it's really real. You know, there's two kinds of movies. There's movies that you watch, and then there's movies that you really experience. And I much prefer to make the latter kind. So having a sort of a naturalism and a realism to the style is very, very important to me. And this isn't a movie where, like, you know, I wave the camera around so I can say, look, Ma, I went to film school. This is a movie where it's about telling the story and pulling the audience into it and getting people, you know, to move to the edge of their seat. Yeah, the big chase scene that we have, and in the big chase scene that we have, there is no city on the planet Earth that would ever let us film a city like that, a scene like that, because it was so destructive. So what we wound up having to do for that sequence was to actually build our own city streets, and we went out to an airstrip in Downey, and we built several blocks of downtown Los Angeles. And it was an amazing set to stand out in because we had everything. We had the buildings, we had the, you know, the telephone poles, we had the street lights. It was having your own private place. And of course we destroyed it all, but it was one of the most exciting sets I've ever stood on. In terms of the number of cars we destroyed, I couldn't even begin to count the number of cars we destroyed. And we had people, you know, going in the recycler and, you know, going to people's houses to, like, buy their, you know, 1987 Chevy Impala and, you know, probably some nice elderly couple waving goodbye as the nice young man drives away with the car and then turns the corner and, like, gets loaded onto a truck and brought over to our set so we could demolish it. So, you know, there's probably a lot of people out there who can go watch this movie and they may or may not recognize their own cars being destroyed in Terminator 3. No, I after 9/11, I came onto this movie before 9/11 and developed a screenplay, and then 9/11 happened, and there were some things that I just felt weren't appropriate in light of 9/11. So there was a sequence involving an airplane that I did remove, and we never shot it. No.
Right. Oh, I'm sorry. Did you have more?
No.
Rightly or wrongly, action is sometimes equated in people's minds or in the copy that we write as violence, and I wonder if where you come down on that element of it. Does action necessarily have to include violence? Because, for instance, I think that the body count in this film is pretty awesome. And some young kids may say, that's awesome, that's cool. But there are others who would say, does it have to be that bloody?
Well, when you say the body count, I'm curious, because nobody gets killed in the movie.
I think there are a lot of dead.
Well, because there's a couple of people that get killed. I'll take that back. But
when there's a room full of people. When she
oh, that stuff.
Room,
oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah, right.
The point is made that he doesn't right. kill anybody.
Yes,
but
yes.
She kills with
right, yes, 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 of course. The kind of violence that I object to is watching for entertainment purposes one character inflicting pain, physical pain on another character, when that's done to be sort of entertainment. In this movie, we don't have you know, humans inflicting pain on other humans. This is a movie about man versus machine. And so scenes in which machines, and it's a science fiction movie, let's face it, scenes in which machines are rising up to do battle with humans is, you know, not, I don't equivocate that with the same kind of equate that with the same kind of violence that you're talking about, and it's much more symbolic. I mean, obviously, we are as a species right now locked in a love-hate relationship with machinery. So movies are often, you know, extremely dramatic and hyperbolic ways of expressing the same issues that go on in our daily lives.
In my mind, you're three for three now. Two questions.
Oh, yes. I hope you're a reviewer.
Yeah. One is, this was, you know, you could have stumbled. This was a big undertaking. It
right.
went wrong. What was your mindset of it? And also, are you one of these directors that's saying, gee, I wish they'd let me do a romantic comedy, or are you happy doing a great work like this?
I love that question. So how are you happy doing great work like this? How can I object to a question like that? I've been really lucky. I've always just gotten to make the movies I've wanted to make. I started really as writing. I've always written my movies. This is the first movie I came into where I didn't create the Terminator. That's a universe that was created by Jim Cameron 2 decades ago. But I've always been very lucky. I've just gotten to make the movies that interest me. I've never been stopped from making a movie. But, you know, even when I did Breakdown, for example, every studio in town passed on Breakdown. And I had studio executives looking me right in the eye going, you know what, this is, you're just going to destroy your career by doing this movie. Not that I even had a career at that point, but they just said, this is, you know, you do a movie like this and you'll never work again and it's terrible and it won't work for all these reasons. And I've always just sort of stuck to my own guns. And when I think I have a story that I'm excited about, I can't wait to tell that. You know, I would love to do a comedy. I'd love to do a romantic comedy, but I always just find myself pulled in certain directions by stories that get in my head and then I can't release. When I did U-571, again, at the time, every studio said, nobody's going to make a World War II movie. Certainly you'll never get to make a movie on water. That's crazy. Universal Pictures, you know, almost went under doing a movie on water. Well, what happened? I wound up persevering. I made a movie on water, and who distributed it? Universal Studios. So I've just been very, very stubborn, I suppose you'd say, but it's all comes from that. Once I get interested in making a particular story, I can't let go. So at some point, if I ever get interested in making a romantic comedy, I probably will, you know, even if I have to go several years before making a movie, I'll probably wind up somehow figuring out a way to make it because I want to. But I've just been lucky that so far nobody has stopped me from doing what I want. They've put up obstacles, but they haven't succeeded in stopping. Yeah, yeah.
And I think, you know, it's a good movie, and the reaction has been universal. But if people came in and say, this thing's just phenomenal.
Yeah, the worst thing you can get is overhyped. And we just saw it with another movie that will go unnamed that everybody thought was going to be the movie of the year. And through no fault of the filmmakers, through no fault even of the studio distributing it, just in its own sort of organic inertia, just got out of control. And people, you know, I mean, you would have had to present everybody in the audience with, like, you know, a bowl full of, like, rubies and diamonds to, you know, get them to meet their expectation level of satisfaction they would have expected. So I'm always happy when people tell me they're very skeptical about Terminator 3, because I know that they will be pleasantly surprised when they go see it. And I've been having a great time. I mean, when we, you know, we went to Cannes a few weeks ago, and you know, the Europeans particularly are incredibly skeptical, and I'm enjoying it because I've played this movie. I wouldn't put this movie out if I hadn't tested it in front of some test audiences. I've put this movie in front of test audiences, and I know what the audience reaction is. So I'm just sort of sitting back, and I probably shouldn't even have said that because that overhypes the movie already. But to answer your question in the shortest way possible, I'm much prefer this situation where people come in with lower expectations. Same for myself as a moviegoer. I whenever I go in overhyped about something, I'm always disappointed. You know, look at Titanic. I mean, everybody thought Titanic was going to be, you know, a disaster and it's the biggest movie of all time, you know. So I think it's all about expectations. And nowadays, with so much media coverage about movies and all that, it's a very slippery slope to fall into to start overhyping a movie.
Who's the ideal test audience for a movie like this? Is it the hardcore sci-fi fans or people who don't know, who really don't care?
I did both because the interesting thing with Terminator is that, you know, it's a huge movie. For it to be successful, it has to work for a worldwide mainstream audience. But I also know it's got to work for the hardcore fans, because those are the first people who, if they're not happy, they're going to go on the internet and start complaining about the movie and send me angry letters. So I had to make sure that really both constituencies were happy with it.
Were you prepared to deal with the internet as an entity coming into this? I mean, did you know that this is something you're going to... All of a sudden, you've got this to worry about.
Yeah. Well... You know, it's sort of a love-hate thing. I love going to the internet, and I visit these movie sites, and I find them very interesting. But as a filmmaker, I must say that the irony is that the very movie fan sites that try to celebrate movie making have actually made it much harder to make good movies, and in fact, some way you could argue have made movies worse, because they've discouraged a whole generation of filmmakers and studios from testing movies. You know, from the beginning days of silent two-reelers, they always took movies and always tested them in front of an audience, because movies are a mass appeal art form. And, you know, unless you're making a small, you know, art picture, Hollywood movies are for, you know, are for big, wide audiences. And you want to make sure, same way that plays always got tested before they went to Broadway, you want to make sure that it's working, that it's dramatically working, that the pacing's right. And nowadays, everybody's terrified to test their movies because they're afraid that they're going to read some bad review on the internet, and that causes sort of a bad publicity spin. And by the way, all the entertainment journalists, every entertainment journalist I've ever met, it confesses to me that they go on all these websites as well. So these websites actually have, their reach isn't so much the maybe the few hundred thousand people who read the sites, it's the few hundred key journalists that read those sites and may have their opinions affected by that. So I don't know what the solution to it is. It's sort of the genie is out of the bottle. I'm not sure how you put it back in. You know, there's so many films that would be so much better had the filmmaker had the opportunity to put it in front of an audience and find out that maybe, you know, the last third was boring, or some actor didn't work, or a joke didn't work, or whatever. In the case of our movie, we just had total secrecy from the beginning. Nobody had the scripts. The few copies of the script that existed were printed on a kind of paper that I found that can't be Xeroxed. Every copy of the script was individualized, and others had unique phrases and words that were put in each copy, so if somebody tried to retype the script, we would be able to track it down. Everybody signed non-disclosure agreements so that should somebody violate that, we could both sue them and pursue criminal penalties against them. We were vigorous in making sure that you know, the story didn't leak out, because, you know, when I go to see a movie, I want to be surprised when I get to the movie theater. I don't want to read about it for 2 months, you know, in the newspaper or the internet. So we were really, really careful on that front. And when we even had our test screenings, we made sure that we could vet every member of the audience and make sure that it was, you know, they were all people that we could trust. And even last night when we had our press screening, I don't know if you noticed, but I'm sure you see this now in all the screenings, they have the guys, the infrared things. And you know, they were going to have them there the whole time, and I said to the studio, I said, well, that's really distracting. You know, if you have them come in a couple of times and check, that's okay. But, you know, that's really, I mean, and this is not, you know, the audience, I'm afraid, of whipping out a video camera.
Jonathan, how much today do directors need to be sort of high-tech wizards with all the special effects and all that? I mean, it's really not like the old days, you know?
Well, you probably can't be like a Luddite, but you know, really... It's about telling the story, and it's very, I mean, we've all seen the movies where, and I, having now lived through this is my first big CG-intensive movie. You know, U571 had a lot of effects, but they're more sort of traditional miniature and model-type work. I can see how it's very easy for a filmmaker to get capsized by all the technological demands of making these kind of movies. You have to understand the technology. You have to be a very quick study. You have to be a fan of technology and not be afraid of you know, if you kind of were afraid of doing high school physics or trigonometry, it's probably not a good job profession to have doing these kind of movies. But on the other hand, your job, and you're the only person on the set really whose sole responsibility it is to do this, is to make sure that you're guarding the story and you're making sure that every day we're coming in and doing things to tell the story. So you always have visual effects people will come up to you and go, hey, you know, it'd be cool, we could do this and that would look really great. But my attitude is if it doesn't advance the story, it's not worth doing. And so, again, another long-winded answer to a simple question, but I think good story, it will always be about good storytelling. Even, 100 years from now when we're making holograms, it's still going to be about storytelling.
What about making the story work this time? I'm sorry.
Oh.
What was really making the film work, I thought, was the story. And I was one of those who walked in making
right,
the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Can you talk about the daunting task of following up after T2, where in our minds the story was over?
Yeah. Well, when I first got a phone call saying you've been offered Terminator 3, I had no idea that anyone was making the movie at that point. My first reaction was, gee, why make Terminator 3? Because I felt the story was over in Terminator 2. But then as I thought about it, the unique opportunity here was that unlike so many sequels that get sort of churned out immediately after the first movie is a hit, 12 years will have passed since Terminator 2. And John Connor, who was played by Eddie Furlong in the last movie, is psychologically in a very different point in his life. And I thought that was really interesting. If you think of like the Michael Apted documentary, 28 Up, just to forget about, anybody's in like a chase or being pursued by robots, just watching someone, grow in front of your eyes from, teenager to adulthood is a fascinating issue. And then you add in the component, here's a character who for a decade has been walking around with a question mark hanging over his head. Is he, the leader of the world? Or is he some loser who rides around on a motorcycle and sleeps under bridges? And what would that do to you over a period of 10 years to wrestle with that sort of daunting existential question? So to me, that was the entry point into making another installment. And the most difficult task, more so even than making sure that we had great action and great visual effects, was making sure that we had a story that was worthy of this franchise and of really kind of now creating the third and what I hope people will perceive as a trilogy. No, with another actor, it absolutely would have shut down production. Okay, Arnold is such a trooper. I had no idea how badly we were abusing him until about a month after we wrapped the show, wrapped photography. I read in the newspaper he'd just gone in for shoulder surgery. And I called up. I said, what happened? He said, I kind of wrecked my shoulder when we were shooting some sequences in the movie. And I said, Arnold, you never said anything to me. He goes, I didn't want to complain. And, we had a sequence in a shootout where a special effects man made a mistake and put a squib right where his hand was. And he's holding this huge metal coffin in one arm, and in the other arm he's holding this 50 caliber machine gun that it would take about four of us just to lift up. Normally they're mounted on Jeeps, so he's holding that, and he's in the middle of a shootout scene. We were doing a shot, it was about a 30 second shot. I call cut. He calmly puts down the gun and the coffin, and then he just very quietly says, there's been a little mistake, somebody should take a, the medic should come take a look at my finger. And the medic runs over, and literally this explosion had gone off in his hand, and he was, completely calm about it. The production manager came over and we started figuring that we'd have to shut down for the day. And Arnold's like, what, don't you want a second take? And he was like ready to go back to work immediately. Any other actor would have been screaming, I want that idiot fired and creating a whole scene about it. And Arnold is just the biggest, professional I've ever met in my life. And just nothing stops the show with him. I don't remember the exact, thing that it took, but it was like his hand was like, he was wearing a glove and it had exploded through the glove and was and gone into his hand was, causing his hand to bleed.
Thank
you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate that. Thank you. Appreciate that. Thank you.